Best country. Doors closing. Please stand clear.
98.9 FM News.
Across Australia, this is Adam Evans with the National Indigenous News. The Queensland government is being urged to follow through on its election promise and make sure mining giants are forced to clean up their mess. The call comes ahead of legislation to go before the state parliament, which would require mining companies to fully rehabilitate their sites. Rick Humphreys from Lock the Gate Alliance says not only would it mean a better outcome for the environment, it would lead to thousands of new jobs.
There's around 15,000 abandoned mines in Queensland, and 350 of them are very large or large mines. These are the ones we really need to worry about, because they're the ones that are likely to be leaching toxic and acidic pollution into our rivers and groundwater. They're the ones that have got to be fixed up as a matter of urgency. If the government chooses to tighten up the legislation and put in place bold targets to encourage progressive rehabilitation in the mining industry, we're likely to see billions of dollars worth of investment brought forward, and as a result, thousands of jobs created, particularly in central Queensland, where they're sorely needed right now.
Lex Wotton will address Palm Island community members about a $30 million class action settlement that has been reached with the Queensland government. A community meeting will take place on the island on Thursday following a briefing in Townsville on Wednesday. It comes after the state government revealed it reached the settlement with 447 claimants in the 2016 class action. Mr. Wotton's federal court class action resulted from the police response to unrest on the island that followed Palm Island man Cameron Dumagee's 2004 death in custody being deemed racist. Speaking after the meeting in Townsville, Mr. Wotton said the struggle he had endured in his fight for justice on behalf of the community had not been recognised by its leadership. Mr. Wotton said few had stood up for him or the community despite an endless stream of negative publicity. I know there's a lot of bad things on social media, but no matter what you say or do, it's not going to change what the Court of Law announced, he told AAP. The settlement needs to be approved by the federal court. The Aboriginal Legal Service New South Wales is calling for the state government to back the findings of a report into a Western Sydney Youth Koori Court program, which they hope will be extended to other regions. A report conducted by Western Sydney into the Youth Diversionary Program run out of Parramatta said it has been successful in reducing recidivism through culturally appropriate action and support plans. The program works on a case-by-case basis to tackle issues contributing to an individual youth's reoffending, such as a lack of housing, education, substance abuse and unemployment. Chair of the ALS, Bunja Smith, wants it to be expanded across the state.
It's brought about changes in the attitudes of the youth. It's all about anything we can do to reduce the shameful rates of Aboriginal incarceration by having community-led solutions. And this particular one, we've seen a lot of our young people diverted away from the criminal justice system. Over 88% of people that we talk to say that these types of programs help to stop offending behaviour. The review shows that it's working, so because of that, I anticipate that it will continue. And we actually call on the New South Wales government to back the findings of the report and provide funding for the expansion.
We'll have sport coming up next.
The Australian government is investing more in a new childcare package to help parents and carers work, train, study and volunteer. The new childcare package starts 2nd July. As part of the package, a new childcare subsidy will replace the two current childcare payments. To transition to the subsidy, you'll need to provide some new information and confirm your current details now through MyGov. Go to education.gov.au/childcare to find out more information. The new childcare package, more support for more families. Authorised by the Australian Government, Canberra. Spoken by Dee Doolan.
Program sponsor.
Here's sport with the ABC.
In rugby union, Rugby Australia CEO Raylene Castle admits she doesn't have an answer at the moment to the problem of Wallabies and Waratahs star Israel Folau and his religious beliefs. Folau tweeted a video by an American Christian evangelist this week which warned against tolerating same-sex marriage. Last month, the Australian rugby star suggested gay people would go to hell if they didn't repent their sins. Castle has told Fox Sports dealing with Folau and his beliefs is a huge conundrum.
What I can say is, in my career, this is the singularly most difficult thing I've ever had to deal with. And that's because there's no black and white answer. On the one hand, you're dealing with a human rights issue, and on the other hand, you're dealing with a freedom of speech. And someone's right to express their views, whether it be religious or otherwise. And I think the test continues to be whether that's done in a respectful way.
And that's the latest National Indigenous News.
Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Bo Spearham with Let's Talk.
When I see you, when I see you in the morning light, then I know everything will be all right. Yes, 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 darling, I love you so. Said I love you so. And when I hear you, oh, it sounds just like an angel song.
And you're back on 98.9 FM. I'm your host, Bo Spearham. That was Uncle Archie Roach with his song. What the name of that song just then? What's it called? Love in the Morning. Yes, yes. Also, Uncle Archie Roach and the Titters, they will be here in Brisbane tomorrow night. And One of our CEO, his younger sister, one of his younger sisters is performing alongside the Titters and Uncle Archie Roach as well. So big shout out to sister girl Tila there. I've got a few people on the program this morning. We'll have Carver, CEO, yeah, with us. Just walked into the studio, just got in. Also Chris Graham.
Howdy.
And we have Uncle Rod Little, co-chair of Congress, National Congress of Australia's First People. I'll just quickly dial him in because we have him for the first few minutes of the program this morning. So I would love to get a comment from him because National Congress and some other peak orgs had a press conference yesterday after the budget down there in Canberra. So it'd be good to get Uncle on the program this morning. I'll just quickly cross over just to see if he is still with us.
Yep, I'm here, Bo.
Oh, good morning, Uncle. Just before we start, could I get you to tell us your name, your mob, and where you're from?
Yeah, my name is Rod Little. I'm from the Willinyu and Wajak mobs in Western Australia, Yamaji Nyuwa peoples. And I'm the co-chair of the National Congress of Australia's First Peoples.
Yep. And in the studio with us as well, like I said before, we have Chris Graham and also Carver. Carver, just before we start, could I get you to tell us your name, your mob, and where you're from?
Yeah, my name's Carver Watson. My mob are Biri Gubba and Kungaloo people. And I work here at Brisbane Indigenous Media Association.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Mr. Graham.
And Chris Graham as well. Introduce yourself,
I'm Chris Graham. My mob is a bunch of mixed white fellas from Sydney. And I also work upstairs at the National Indigenous Radio Service and also New Matilda.
We'll get straight into it, Unc. The National Congress yesterday had a press conference in Canberra after, the 2018-19 budget. Could you tell us a bit about, what was the press conference for? And also there were some things at the press conference that is very, that was very upsetting to our people, feeling like we're being neglected once again.
Yeah, that's correct. Can I first of all say acknowledge all the brothers there and all your mobs, and it's good to be with you to talk to you about this stuff. As I said yesterday, often, generally with budgets, our mob don't feature very well in these kinds of things, particularly pre-election budgets. We seem to be, once again, marginalised, and our needs aren't being met. And when we talk about, and when governments and treasurers and all that talk about prosperity and so on, and they create all these big jobs, a lot of our mob not actually getting those jobs and not benefiting from these budgets. Mm-hmm. In fact, we really need the stuff to be done beforehand so that we are healthier, that we are stronger than what we are now. We are very strong in our survival. But to be able to participate and care for your families and live healthier lives, that is one of the fundamental things of society and humanity, Mm-hmm. I just can't believe consistently over years and years of seeing these budgets be handed down when they want to have say that they want to do things with us, not to us. But this is another, feels like another kick in the gut.
Definitely. And I think one of the big things as well was the promise of over 6,000 jobs to a lot of our mob in remote communities. And over the last few years, we've seen, a lot of outcry from our mob, and also over the last few years, particularly from the new establishment of a union, First Nations Workers Alliance, that has really taken it to the government in terms of the CDP program.
Yeah. And I mean, that's fantastic work. And we have a long history of that. That kind of support for our mob, Waveville is just one of those examples. But again, I can recall some time ago when there was this promise from a big mining company in Western Australia for about 50,000 jobs. Wouldn't that be great for our mob? 50,000 permanent jobs that our people can have would be fantastic. But as our population grows, that 6,000 promised jobs, and they're not even full-time permanent jobs that will last for a long time. Mm. And our community organisations are the biggest employers of our mob, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where the investment should be made, is to build the capacity of our peoples to have the skills enough to do the jobs that they want to do and not be prejudiced against when they go to apply for any jobs in mainstream or elsewhere.
And another thing with this CDP program as well, and also with there's a lot of backlash with Sunlink as well, especially with the, you know, if these mob that are on the CDP program, you know, if they have three strikes against them, you know, there is the, you know, them getting cut off for 8 weeks as well.
Yeah. Well, the regime, as far as we're concerned, for penalising, you know, that penalty regime doesn't match up or doesn't correlate fairly with the required times to be, you know, in work. So they've increased it to 25 hours or something, I think, mm-hmm. I got to get this right about that, but I'm not that expert on that kind of arrangement. But the penalising for that, if they thought about the flow-on effect, is that if you're not able to meet your appointment, you get all these strikes and then you end up having to, you know, not make any income, then, you know, what does that lead to? You know, what does it lead to? Does it lead to fines and so on like that? And then fines leads to, you know, well, can't pay the fine, so you might end up with a imprisonment.
Mm.
Well, it's Carver here, and it just seems like another form of welfare dressed up. You know, the CDP program. We were speaking to Lara Watson last week, and this thing around the amount of money that it's actually cost to roll out this scheme, you know, is almost, I think, it's only 70 cents of the dollar that actually even reaches the ground, or even if that, I think it might be 70 cents to the dollar
doesn't
it's tied up, it doesn't
yeah,
make
it, doesn't
it.
Reach,
yeah. And so, you know, it seems like this perpetuation of just continuing to see our people in this welfare state. I mean, surely there are better ways to invest, you know, invest money and actually really create economic development in communities.
Yes, I totally agree with you, Joe. There are better ways to do this, and I think the group led by APONT and Laura and the mob there, you know, they've all got solutions about how we could work this, you know. And basically what we want is equality, you know, fundamental equality. Yet these, you know, each budget, politicians, et cetera, will think that they need to manage us, blackfellas. You know, I mean, that's a historical misperception that they need to do these things for us. We're long time survivors, you know, we know how to survive. We have come up with solutions. We know how to survive. I mean, there were many things that there are claims that were wrong with CDEP, but at least they had the naming right. There was community development and employment program. This CDP is just the community development program, but it is rolled out as an employment program. It doesn't make sense. You're absolutely right. It is just keeping the control of the most vulnerable.
It seems like Work for the Dole with a different name, essentially.
That's all.
Yeah, more hours required and greater penalties.
That's the illogical approach to this whole thing about CDP and employment for our mob. Rather than looking, we made some comments yesterday, Congress and I did, and it was about, if this is a political budget, there's an election coming up, all the investment in industry, in infrastructure, there is opportunity for our mob to get jobs in civil engineering or civil works, and, you know, all those road buildings, construction, whatever. What the government hasn't done is taking into account the lead time for that, so that people can develop the skills and get the qualifications in the period before the projects actually start. And we've got a ready workforce. Mm-hmm. And I think those are the illogical things. The logical things that we are proposing You know, our mob propose these solutions all the time to these guys, but they come with it from a welfare approach. We know this. We see this time after time. And the same with other parts of the sector as well. You know, the homelessness, the other people who are on welfare, people with disabilities. They see that those guys are those sectors are dependent on government. But, you know, they don't need to control those sectors.
I know you're short of time, but I'd love to sort of just get your thoughts on, obviously, you know, Congress is made up of, but the membership is peak bodies for all different sort of industries.
Yep.
and you know, and issues that are affecting our communities from, you know, health to incarceration and across the full range and ambit of issues affecting mob. What are some, I guess, the shortfalls, do you think, in this budget? What are some of the areas that aren't being adequately addressed or invested in?
Well, I think many of the things that we've been saying for a long time, and that key, you know, groups that you've mentioned now, the Redfern Statement, that is an alliance of those peak organisations, and each one of them have said things around, you know, the incarceration rates. That really has to be addressed. And in response, I think the government's sort of mild response to that is CDP, is prison to work, but there's no investment in it, you know? So that is just crazy. The other thing which has really, really been a crisis for us is the incarceration rates. That, you know, we're 3+% of the population, and we've got 27% of our mob in prison.
Mm.
That doesn't match up. The other is the removal of our kids. That is horrific. You know, how are we supposed to, you know, for our develop a future for our generations when this is the kind of treatment that we receive from our broader society and in particular successive governments, not just this one, but, you know, they can, if by comparison, you can see which ones will be worse and which ones are not. But the other things about, you know, the violence against our women, you know, the lack of focus, real focus in giving our blokes, our men, a good opportunity to play their part in their families and in community and to care for their families. And, you know, rather than being not able to get a job, being further marginalised from their families and so on, and then poked in prisons and things like that, which then prevents them from actually getting jobs.
Rod, you mentioned violence against women in the budget,
yeah.
And in fact in Nigel Scullion's own media release highlighting the best parts of the budget, they allocate $18.2 million. I mean, well, on the one hand, they make an awful lot of noise about violence against women, and they should. But the demonising of Aboriginal men in that process is, you know,
absolutely
been large. But in response, and they announce $18.2 million in funding to maintain an alert system and a counselling service. What do you think of their efforts in that area?
I think their efforts is. And if you look at all of the responses in these kinds of areas, it's the reactionary response rather than to having a look at the causes of these issues. A lot of the health stuff are preventable, all right, and a lot of this violence stuff is preventable if you're investing in people to build their capacities to, you know, hold a strong family, raise a family, do the things that other people want to do. And I got to tell you, look, Will, I don't know of any fella that wants to have a family and just beat them up. Why do you have a family? You want a family to care and love them, you know? And that's fundamentally what they're, but like you say, well, these guys sort of demonise us in this equation so that there is reaching out to those in society to say, you know, we're the bad bunch and we need to be locked up. Well, that's not always the case. If we are able to participate, have a job, stand and feel proud about what we do and care for our families and our country and our mob, I think that would be a better outcome. There will be better outcomes if there was a focus there.
There's a spectacular,
even if we tested it.
Yeah, there's a spectacular irony, of course, because the 18.2 million is, I mean, they're spending 2.5 times more on a statue for Captain Cook.
Yeah. Yeah, and when you have a look at the scale of like our life expectancy, you know, from the early years, there's little to no investment in those in health, early education, early development, and so on. But if you look at the other end of the spectrum, there's more investment in post schooling, in detention centres, justice, family violence, you know, all those kinds of things. And then our life expectancy, getting down to that end of the scale, even aged care for us. I know there's a bit in this budget for aged care, but it seems like as often this stuff is a little too late and you're reacting to the crisis.
And I'd be interested to know actually where that's going as well. We know that there's certainly a preference to be funding large non-Indigenous NGOs, you know, to roll out Indigenous programs, which, again, you know, it's the fundamental thing of lacking community input and guidance as to, you know, what priorities are and the best way forward. But, Uncle, we've kept you way over time, but one last question. Have Congress had any sort of commitment out of this budget in terms of seeing you fellas through? Because I know that there's been uncertainty around, you know, any sort of adequate funding or, you know, support to be sustainable as Congress?
Yeah, the answer is no, straight up. But our question is now for three things. One is that the Redfern statement, when it was launched, the ask within in the return of $535 million to Aboriginal organisations that suffer the cuts, even though the minister will argue that these cuts didn't happen. In 2014-15, when that budget was handed down, there was lots of cuts made to and our mob, we were sacrificed then, and there would have been people in our community-controlled organisations that lost their jobs and didn't know, you know, they had no future, basically. The Redfern statement was called for that monies to be reinstated to assist our organisations and our peoples get back into the economy. The other thing was that when Congress was established and there was a forward commitment of $15 million, and this $15 million we had asked at that time to be returned to Congress to enable us to participate more and give, you know, inform government. So we managed to survive. So we didn't get that money. We managed to survive. The budget's got better. What we're asking now is the budget's better. We've made our sacrifice then. We've been working with government, particularly through the Closing the Gap and the Redfern statement, on those asks, you know, around providing solutions around health, education. We've got a housing conference coming up next year, an international one, which is one of those fundamental rights that we believe that we have, the same as others, you know. That's one of the things that if we got those houses, you know. So these are important information we've been informing governments. This is where you should be investing your money. They've ignored that and they haven't committed to refunding Congress. And all we were asking for was this $15 million over that since 2014, which would have brought us to June this year. And we would have been better off now than we are at the moment. We're struggling and we're chasing, you know. we used to say we were living on rations, you know.
Yeah,
And that $15 million. I don't want to labour a point, but it represents less than a third of what they're spending on a Captain Cook statue, which I'm going to keep. Repeating.
You know, some of the other, you know, the dialysis stuff. You know, their more money could have gone into theirs.
Absolutely. Well, they've spent bugger. I think it's 30-something million, and $100 million on a memorial in France. So.
Yeah, exactly. You know, when people are in, you know, black and white people in this country are welfare dependent and they're kept at welfare dependent levels, and there's no investment in those people to participate in the economy or, you know, improve their lives, yet you're throwing $100 million at the memorial.
Yeah.
Doesn't make sense, eh?
No, it doesn't at all. Hey, Unc, we'll let you go here because we know you have some meetings on this morning. I just want to say a big thank you for joining us this morning. And if you are just tuning in, my guest on the my guests are our co-chair, Uncle Rod Little from the National Congress of First Australians. Also have Carver Watson and also Chris Graham. We're going to head to a quick song and we'll be back after that. This song I'm going to go to is Vic Sims with Stranger in My Country. Good song for having this conversation. You're listening to 98.9 FM.
Thanks, bro.
Thanks, son.
Stranger in my country, stranger in my land, today to somewhere, no account, tomorrow something grand. I doubt if you'd agree with me, or if you'd understand. Till that day, for guys like me, I'm a stranger in my land. Well, forgive me if it seems as though, but I am not mistaken. 'Cause I'm the one who you forgot after my land was taken. In early years we were put down, cast aside as vermin. Women, men and kids shot down, then paid by Bible sermon. Well, don't try to understand me now, I've seen the sights that pain you. Has it really changed for me since Roundup in Tasmania? I'm a stranger in my country, stranger in my land. Today to somewhere, no account, tomorrow something grand. I doubt if you'd agree with me, or if you'd understand. Till that day, for guys like me, I'm a stranger in my land. Black is beautiful, I've heard it far and wide, man. Are you sincere in what you say? If not, please step aside then. This land is like a store-bought pie, and lots of people come all to get themselves a slice, and I can't get a crumb. Australian has his pride, his culture and his dream time. Easy to lose all this as well, I wonder in the meantime. I'm a stranger in my country, stranger in my land. Today to somewhere, no account, tomorrow something grand. I doubt if you'd agree with me, if you'd understand. Till that day, for guys like me, I'm a stranger in my land. I'm a stranger in my land. I'm a stranger in my land. I'm a stranger in my land.
We all know grog is linked to liver disease, but there's also a risk for cancer too. Here's Chris McMillan, CEO of Cancer Council Queensland.
Look, there's a number of types of cancers linked to alcohol. Breast cancer is certainly one of them. Colon cancers, liver cancers, and the obvious one, oral cavity and pharynx cancers. And I guess one of the things is that, you know, the links are there. And so the caution is to people to really try and stick to the guidelines in terms of the consumption of alcohol, because if you can help prevent disease like a cancer, that's well worth it.
The 2009 Australian Guidelines to Reduce Health Risk from Alcohol is under revision, but currently states no more than two standard drinks per day reduces the lifetime risk of alcohol-related disease or injury. To keep on top of your health, see your doctor at your local Aboriginal Medical Service for regular health checks. For more information, head to cancerqld.org.au.
A message from the Staying Strong Project, funded by the Australian Government Department of Health.
Hey, Ange.
Yes, sis.
We're moving.
Oh, my God.
We're moving to Friday.
Thank God.
It's Wild Black Woman.
Thank God it's Wild Black
Woman. It's Wild Black Woman on a Friday. Thank God it's Friday. Friday with an F, not a TH.
That's right. Wild Black Women are moving 9 till 10 Friday mornings. So listen or stream 98.9 FM for Wild Black Women. It's Chelsea Bond and Angelina Hurley with Wild Black Women 9 till 10 Friday mornings. Friday fun day.
This is Bo Spearham with Let's Talk.
And you're back on Let's Talk. Today on the show, on the program, you would have heard from Uncle Rod Little, co-chair of the National Congress of Australia's First People. And in the studio also, we have Chris Graham and Carver Watson. And we were yarning about the budget. And
yeah, the budget.
The bloody budget.
Budget, love, budget.
Well, we were just talking off air, this it's being sort of pitched as, you know, an election budget aimed to, I guess, get some support of the swinging centre. Is that what they call them? The centre?
Yeah, the centre. It's middle class
to lower
income. Yeah, the middle income Australians. It's a real pitch to the Liberal base. It's the peanut butter budget. It's kind of smooth and tasty, but it's still just nuts when you look at it. It's not.
Did you just think of that?
Or yeah, I had to work the word peanut butter into it. That's my word of the day.
Oh, you got a word of the day.
That was quite good. Smooth and tasty, but still just nuts.
Yeah, okay.
I can apply that to anything now.
Yeah.
But it genuinely is. It's a. In one sense, it's a quite a clever budget. I watched the budget speech unfold, and I thought, this is a pretty clever budget. He's dropped taxes. He's made a pitch to the middle and lower income earners, but it is a clever budget, but it is also a very bad budget. I mean, in the Indigenous affairs spending, they're not really doing anything new, and that's typical of an election budget for a Liberal government. They're just maintaining the status quo while things progressively get worse. And one of the really insidious parts of this budget is what they're ultimately trying to do. This is the first step in flattening the tax rate. What that means is that they're trying to get the tax rate down so that everybody's on the same level. So if you're on $200,000 a year, you will pay the same tax rate eventually as someone on $40,000 a year, which means...
That's a very conservative ideal, isn't it?
Well, it is. It's libertarian and conservative. It's this theory that we should pay the same. Well,
you shouldn't be taxed for performing higher or better than other people.
Yeah, that's how they express it. The reality is, though, the more money you earn, the more spending power you have. And the more spending power you have, the more money you earn. Mm. And the other reality is that if you've got two people born in a country, one's born poor, one's born wealthy, and they have the same opportunities, undeniably the statistics anywhere in the world will show that the person born wealthy will end up far better off than the person born poor. And so this notion that, you know, it's an American notion that any man can grow to be president, there are exceptions to the rule. People like Lowy, who built Westfield, like they came in with nothing. But generally speaking, 99% of the time, that's not what happens. I mean, Malcolm Turnbull tries to cast himself as coming from a poor background. He inherited $1 million from his dad. Donald Trump. Yeah, oh, I only got 2 million. Oh, you poor bastard. I
mean, or that Liberal MP the other day who said, oh, you know,
I could live on $40 a week. $40 a day.
Yeah.
She owns six houses. You can't pay rent on $40 a day. No. I mean, it's a really bad... it's a very irresponsible budget, but it's very in line with what we've seen from Liberal and Labor in terms of budgets.
Everyone will remember the 2014 budget, the end of the age of entitlement. But this, I keep going
was
on
it
about.
Was Joe Hockey smoking a cigar
yeah,
on the park
Joe
bench?
Hockey with Matthias Cormann.
Remember that?
Well, they were sitting in Parliament in an area they thought they wouldn't be photographed, smoking cigarettes like two, you know, fat cat bureaucrats putting money in their pockets. But, you know, that 2014 budget, apparently, you know, they did continue the practice of entitlement, but it was just entitlement to people, you know, who they thought were entitled to be entitled. This budget is much the same. I was banging on about this before, and I'm going to bang on about it for weeks, months potentially, probably years, is the $49 million that they're unveiling to build a statue of Captain Cook and I think a learning centre in Scott Morrison's own electorate. That $49 million is, as we mentioned earlier in the program, it's 2.5 times more than the new money they've announced for tackling domestic violence in Aboriginal communities. It's, you know, it is utterly ludicrous what their priorities are. It's 1.5 times what they're proposing to spend over 4 years, mind you, on the delivery of dialysis to remote areas, on new money on dialysis. And the problems in remote regions in particular with kidney disease are massive. I think it's one of the highest rates in the world.
There was a really... A terrible story on 7:30 report early this year or late last year, and it was about the status of care for people in remote communities all throughout Central Australia. And they had this. It was a doctor there talking about being in a clinic in a remote community and knowing there's only 3 people on the entire waiting list in the Northern Territory, 3 Indigenous people for a transplant. They were in a room full of like 12 to 18 people or something and asked how many people think they're on the waiting list, and everybody put their hand up.
Yeah, wow.
It's gut-wrenching, yeah, you know.
It's pretty horrendous.
Yeah.
The thing about this budget, or the thing about the policy direction of the government, I actually think the policy direction, some of these policy directions are good, that they've acknowledged that CDP, the program, is a disaster, and it was. They're playing politics on it. It was actually Mal Brough, who started unpicking CDEP, and Vanstone. They were the 2 Liberal ministers in the previous administration. Labor then absolutely gutted it and destroyed it, even though they say they wouldn't do it. Scullion has come back in, and they've left it running for, this is 4 years now, but they're acknowledging the massive problems with CDEP and they're trying to resolve it. But there's other policies that they've done really well. One of them is the procurement policy for the government. So they're spending substantially more money with First Nations businesses through government contracts. That's a very good thing and it's a very good policy. But when you weigh up all of their priorities, the biggest problem they have is they slashed a huge amount of money out of the Indigenous Affairs budget in 2014. They haven't really returned it to the levels it was. And they have always, Labor and Liberal, underfunded the Indigenous Affairs budget. They've always done it. Mm-hmm. So you look at the announcement in this budget, $550 million over 5 years, that's 110 per annum for remote housing in the Northern Territory. In 1999, ATSIC, the former commission, did a research paper into unmet housing need in the Northern Territory. And in 1999, it was $2 billion in the Northern Territory alone. Now, that's almost 2 decades ago. The unmet need was $2 billion. They've gone nowhere near getting anywhere near that. And we're two decades down the track and they are still spending over 5 years less than a quarter of what they needed to spend in the Northern Territory alone 20 years ago to fix it. Mm. And that is and I could go on and on about, you can pick through every bit of the budget and this same story is true. They have simply never spent the money that they need to spend to resolve the problems they know exist. And this budget is more of the same. The policy directions in some areas are definitely improved, and they've Labor and Liberal have made good gains in health spending in Aboriginal affairs. There's no denying that. But generally speaking, it is just a complete lack of money in the Indigenous Affairs budget. They know it and they are never going to fix it because there is no electoral gains in lifting Aboriginal people out of disadvantage.
How much money is there in the with this budget?
Well, they say $5 billion. It is very hard to get to the bottom of Indigenous Affairs budgets now because they mix it up and they move it around. It's in PM&C. The figures are hidden all over the place. It used to be much easier. But they say $5 billion. There's a huge irony in that. In the ATSIC days, they spent 9% of their money on administration. Nowadays, the figures are much, much, much higher than that. I don't know if it's 70-30 or 30-70, but most of the money doesn't hit the ground. You look at the Northern Territory Intervention, for example. They spent $150 million on remote housing without building a single house. They spent
CDP is an example. We've spoken about Basics Card. How much did Basics Card cost to develop?
Oh, look, billions. Billions. They will deny that, but it was well over $1 billion. I remember a $400 million appropriation they took to shore up the technology and what have you. To control the incomes of 15,000 people. They should have just given them the money.
They could have bought them all houses.
They could have bought them mansions.
They were supposed to buy them houses and
they didn't do that either.
Didn't they end up using the housing fund to pay for a pool?
Yeah, this comes up in the budget. They used a fund called the Aboriginal Benefits Account. They took $4 million out of that benefits account to contribute to a $20 million pool in Alice Springs for the Alice Springs Town Council. Now, this is Aboriginal mining royalty equivalencies in the Northern Territory that is supposed to be there for the economic development benefits of Aboriginal people. The other thing in this budget, which is cheeky as hell, is they talk about they're replacing the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander land and sea land account with the Land and Sea Future Fund. What they're actually talking about. In 1993, when the Native Title Act passed, the concessions that Aboriginal people made you guys won in court, you beat them, and that created a legislative problem. So in order to work their way through, Aboriginal people agreed to a number of things. One of them was the fund to buy back land.
In areas where Native Title would have been extinguished.
So
for a lot of metro areas like Brisbane and Sydney and other large areas where Native Title has been extinguished, there's an opportunity to purchase land for the Aboriginal community.
Yeah, that was one of the concessions that Aboriginal people gave, and they were quite generous in their negotiations. So that fund that they're talking about is not white money, it's not government money, it's Aboriginal money as compensation for the theft of, the entire continent.
The extinguishment of Native Title. Let's not close the lid on some form of compensation.
And they're talking about that in the budget like it's some sort of magnanimous government investment. It's not. It's almost three decades old. And it's Aboriginal money, and it's been managed by an Aboriginal organisation that is controlled by government. They're now talking. They're saying that the returns on that investment haven't been strong, and they're reshaping it to make it better. But they make out that this is money they're spending. It's not. It's a fund that has been established a long time ago and has been managed responsibly by an Aboriginal organisation, and now they're shaking up. And they've been trying to do that for quite some time. They've been trying to get their hands on the ILC money for a long, long time, just as they use the Aboriginal Benefits Account in the Northern Territory as slush funding. One of the worst to do it was Labor. Labor used to just dip into that fund and they would use that money to fund things like shade shelters in schools. So, if you're a white kid in a white school in Brisbane or Sydney, you get a shade shelter, that's government funded. But if you're a black kid in a black community in the Northern Territory, you have to use Aboriginal mining royalties to pay for the same thing that every other person takes for granted and accepts as a right of their citizenry. So it's quite there's parts of the budget that are dishonest. I would say though, it's better than anything Macklin ever produced. Macklin's been, I think, probably the worst minister for Aboriginal affairs in a long, long time. Malbrough was a joke and not really worth talking about. A complete train wreck. But it's better spending priorities, I think, than we've seen in the past in some areas, but it's just fundamentally grossly underspending the needs. You cannot honestly defend it in any way. If you look at the problems in Aboriginal Australia, everybody knows that there is... massive health problems, massive over-incarceration, massive unemployment. Every social indicator is terrible.
There's been speak of like productivity commissions and that sort of stuff around Indigenous spending.
And they excuse me, and they condemn government, state and territory and federal, every single time they produce a report. It's a biannual report.
Yeah.
Every single time they condemn them. The Northern Territory gets condemned more than anyone. It never changes because the Productivity Commission produced a series of reports. You wouldn't be able to jump over them if you stacked them end on end. They're that thick. They're hard to weigh through, so journalists don't weigh through them. Instead, media advisors for the major political parties go and hand out a helpful press summary. Release. Yeah. Well, not even a summary report, a summary of what they're doing to fix Aboriginal people, even though the report will directly contradict what they say. Mm. I remember this from the Northern Territory a few years ago when one Productivity Commission report came out. It was scathing of the way the Northern Territory government took money aimed at alleviating Aboriginal disadvantage and spent it on anything else. It said that they should have been spending, for example, $60 million a year on homelessness. They were spending $1 million a year on homelessness. So in order to, you know, rebut, knock off the furor around the report, the government put out a press release saying, announcing how happy it was that it was spending $1 million on homelessness, even though it was 1/60th of what it should have been spending based on the Productivity Commission reports. All the media just took up the media release and then presumably went to the pub with all the media advisors that just gave them the media releases.
Mm.
It's a failing of government, obviously, but it's also a failing of the media. You scan the media landscape yesterday and today and find me anyone who's done a comprehensive analysis of the Indigenous Affairs budget. It hasn't happened.
And so... Sorry. So what now? Like, does organisations and stuff have to apply somewhere else for, you know, government funding or for money?
Nah, a lot. So, you know, and so a lot of that stuff is multi-year funding. What it is, I guess, in this round, it's the status quo. I think the big thing is probably the tax stuff, isn't it? The tax rate changes and the like.
Well, look, they've walked away. They're tax cuts. These are tax cuts to middle Australia. And... you know, a lot of people were talking about, you know, keep my $10. These are tax cuts to people who don't need tax cuts, number one. And they're walking away.
$10 a week.
Yeah, well, but when you add it up, they're walking away from tens of billions of dollars.
Yeah.
I think in the tax cuts they've delivered, it's either 23 or 30. I'll double check. But imagine if they pumped $30 billion. Imagine if they said, no, we're not going to give you a $10 a week tax cut. We're going to take that money and we're going to fix the problems we created in Aboriginal Australia. $30 billion, if they provided $30 billion into a fund and lived off the interest of that fund without touching it, that would be $3 billion a year additional that they could pump into Aboriginal housing or anything else. But the reality is they don't do it because they're not going to win an election by resolving the problems in Aboriginal that they've created in Aboriginal Australia. That's how you lose elections.
Mm.
And they're not going to do it. So it is business as usual. They're not going to increase the spending. They're going to continue to underfund Aboriginal organisations. And when things blow up, find ways to convince the media to blame it on Aboriginal people. It's what they've always done.
Yeah, Labor Party. Yeah, and this is the thing. Like, you know, people, there's always, when we talk about Indigenous affairs spending, it's always on the basis of how much money do we pump into Indigenous communities and affairs and still no change. And it comes back to that thing around, you know, productivity. How much of it is actually making it?
Most of it's not. And, you know, I mean, the Northern Territory intervention is one of the great examples. It's certainly the worst policy I've ever seen, but it's one of the worst policies in living memory, apart from maybe the stolen generations.
Mm.
And it's the classic example of how government can just waste so much money, but then get away with blaming Aboriginal people for that wastage.
Now, you've spent time in Canberra. I'm interested in your thoughts. How do you reckon this next election is going to go? Clearly, they're posturing's a word I'm looking for.
Yeah.
Posturing for an election. I've seen before the budget, they let all the cameras in the cabinet room and they're all chummy. And
yeah.
Malcolm's, it's a very good budget, Scott.
Oh, yeah, look, I think the Libs are pretty happy with themselves. The thing that Ben Eltham, our national political reporter for New Matilda, made this point, and it's a very good one. When election time comes round, people tend not to remember tax cuts and the nice things that they think government did for them. Mm. What they remember is the bad things. And so I don't think this government in the polls will get a little bounce, I think, but we've had 30-something straight polls now where Turnbull is way behind Labor. So I think Labor will... I don't think this will affect the election at all. It's impractical to think they will get another budget out before they go to election, so this is their election budget.
Mm.
But, and I think that means that the key game in Aboriginal Australia particularly is what is Labor going to do when they get in office? And that's where, if any media are listening, that's where the focus should be. I think this government probably is shot. Anything can happen in the next year, but I think they're probably done. And therefore, what is Labor going to do? Because the greatest betrayers of Aboriginal affairs have been Labor, undeniably, in the last few decades.
They've got a strong Indigenous contingent there now.
They do, but does anybody know who the Indigenous Affairs spokesperson is?
Shadow Minister?
Yeah,
I believe that's the leader of the opposition, isn't it?
It is, and you're one of the only people who would know that because he says absolutely bloody nothing about it. We can't even get an interview with him on his Indigenous Affairs portfolio. Neither can the National Indigenous Radio Service get an interview with him. They flick us to Pat Dodson all the time. But Shorten has simply taken on that portfolio because Shorten thinks it's a shiny new badge on his shirt and it looks good. They're doing nothing in it. And if there are any journalists listening to this, they need to go after Shilton and they need to go after Labor. That is the real game, and they need to pin these bastards down to what they are going to finally do to A, unpick the failures of the previous government and their previous administration.
Language, mate. That's the second B today.
Did I say the B word? Yeah. Well, it's better than what I wanted to say. But, you know,
uncles and aunties that listen to this.
Yeah,
show.
I'm sorry. Yeah. I apologise. I do get a bit worked up.
Yes, clearly.
Clearly. But they need to pin these fellas down. So
yeah.
They need to pin them down.
I'm the one
doing.
That gets in trouble.
Yeah, I
get the phone calls.
I know. I just disappear into the ether and people cheer me. They need to pin them down on what Labor is going to do to fix this, because all this rhetoric, that's all it is. It's rhetoric. Labor have never done anything to deliver on this. They did deliver ILC and the land fund, but that was part of negotiations. And we haven't seen that sort of spending for a long, long time.
More of the same.
It is. That's exactly what it is. It's infuriating to watch. I don't know how many Indigenous Affairs budgets I've watched now. It'd be, I don't know, 18 or so. And the same thing happens every time. They always deliver about 1.1% of the total national spend to Indigenous Affairs. That's despite the fact that Aboriginal people make up about 3.3% of the population. There's an argument that, you know, Aboriginal people still benefit from roads, et cetera, et cetera. And, of course, that's true. I would argue you don't benefit from justice, for example, where they spend a lot of money. I don't think you benefit from defence particularly. Mm. But, you know, I accept the arguments that the actual spending on Aboriginal people is greater than the $5 billion that they claim. But there is, it's undeniable that things are grossly underfunded in Aboriginal communities. You can't point to a remote community with an average of 17 people living in each dwelling and say that that's not a problem of underfunding. Mm. It is. It so clearly is. And people say, well, they destroy the houses. You try cramming 30 people into a house and see what happens to that house. See how long its lifespan is.
Yeah. And there's wastage everywhere you look in housing and all over the place.
Yeah. And also undeniably, ATSIC was Aboriginal people delivering Aboriginal priorities and Aboriginal programming has undeniably been better than a white mainstream bureaucracy doing it. That's not to say ATSIC didn't have its problems. Of course it did. All government service delivery will have problems. But no one can make a reasonable case that the current arrangements deliver better services to Aboriginal people. It's just fundamentally not true.
You're on all cylinders today, mate.
I am. I get worked up about the budget because it's where the rubber meets the road. It's the most important part. You've seen idiots like Malbrough come out and say, oh, it's not about more spending, it's not about more money. Yes, it is. It's about stopping the underfunding of Aboriginal communities. When you've got dialysis, 12 people need it and 2 people are getting it, that's a problem of funding.
And it's the saying, put your money where your mouth is, it speaks to the priorities, you know. When we look at, if you really want to judge a person or judge someone, you judge them by their actions.
Yeah.
And there's no better way to judge a government's priorities by how they spend the money.
Yeah,
how they allocate money.
Absolutely. And I'll mention it one more time, the Captain Cook statue. It's inconceivable to me that you would have a situation where a rich, wealthy nation like Australia has some of the worst life statistics on earth, some of the worst life expectancy statistics, the highest rate of rheumatic heart disease, trachoma, which is a third world disease, which has been eliminated in many third world countries, but is rampant in Australia. You have a nation that is facing that, and they choose to spend $49 million on a statue of Captain Cook rather than direct that money into anything, domestic violence-related services, health services. It is unconscionable. They spent $100 million in France on a memorial
to try and promote the Anzac myth. I mean, it is, the spending priorities are indefensible. No other humane, well, no humane nation on earth would direct the money the way the Australian governments, but Labor and Liberal, have directed.
At least both, like, acknowledge that, but also acknowledge the first people. Yeah. You know, Richard Flanagan had a good speech at the press club. Did you watch that?
Yeah.
Great author. Great speech too. Encourage our listeners to go check it out. But thanks for having us, Bo.
No, thank you for joining and jumping on the show this morning. You can catch the repeat of Let's Talk 7 p.m. Here on 98.9 FM or on our website at 98.9.